Testing, testing, testing. This is tape number 2 of the story entitled The Boss in the Wall, Atreides on the House Devil, written by Avram Davidson and Grania Davis, read by Goblin Hood. Only to find the sight so real as to drive his small daughter past terror and hysteria.
Do you understand why I'm trying to find out?
He waved his hands helplessly.
What the damned thing was
that vanished in an instant?
One minute it was there. Another minute, nothing was there. Just as though, it had come out of the wall. The police say, tramp. It was no tramp. The only thing it resembled was that old legend, and that's why I'm here. Ed, in my file on the legend is a collection of items labeled Bagnell's notes. I won't go so far as to say they are yellowed, but they are far from crisp. May I ask how you got interested in the legend of the paper man, or whatever name you call it by?
I got interested when I read an unpublished paper on it, and remembered I'd long ago met a possible informant and hadn't realized it. One day when I was a kid, I was walking in a strange part of town, and I came to an old house, abandoned and all overgrown. I thought I'd go in and look around, when a creepy old man hobbled from out of nowhere with torn old clothes and just a few teeth grinding in stubbly jaws. And he smelled very funny. Later, an old lumberjack said to me, as if reading my mind, "Don't go in that old house, boy. A boss in the wall lives there. They're crazy people who think they're dead, and they wrap themselves in paper, and they rattle like snakes and bite like snakes. So don't go in there, boy." Stuart paid the ultimate compliment. He sat straight up and said, "No shit." But I decided that poor old man was just a bum or tramp who staked out a place for himself and didn't want me inside. Years later, I read the unpublished item and all the elements fit. So naturally, I became interested. I wrote a paper on the subject, and mine remains unpublished too. So there you are, gentlemen.
What conclusions did you come to, for example, about the origins of the legend?
Asked Vlad. Bagnell shrugged. It's like trying to trace down the origins of a fog. The fog exists and you can see it, but always seems to begin somewhere else. Compare it to other American legends. That is, you can trace groundhog stories to badger stories, but then you trace them right back to groundhogs. Sometimes we folklorists take every possibility into consideration except the human longing for a good yarn, which sometimes means a good scary yarn. A twig snapped in the fireplace, and Bagnell said, "If fireplaces were concealed inside walls, they might be called snappers. All the legends are attached to old houses, and old houses often creak. They attract drifters and outcasts of broken minds and unclean habits who remind us of childhood terror tales of ghosts and skeletons and God knows what, and so a legend evolves." Vlad asked if Bagnell had anything new to show him. Bagnell suggested he might call Dave Branch, but Vlad reminded him that it was Branch who had sent him to Bagnell. "Well," Bagnell said,
I don't know what to tell you, Vlad. I just don't know what to tell you. Vlad did not move for a while, then he let himself sink back in the chair. Behind him hung a beautiful photograph, an enlargement in sepia, of a group of Ainu at a long-ago American World's Fair. They gazed through the camera, as from some lost continent, too dignified to show their infinite bewilderment and their vast sense of doom. After Vlad and Jack departed, Bagnell picked up the phone. Dr. Bagnell, returning Dr. Branch's call. Hello, Dave. Yes, I know you hadn't called. That's just a ploy, never fails. Sly. Listen, one Vladimir Smith, PhD, he's tracking the Paper Man legend. I just have one question. You didn't mention the committee to him, did you? No, good, that's fine. Back to your learned discourses. Bye. Raw-headed, bloody bones may be an undifferentiated spook, but it is certainly vividly different from the rather enigmatic The Boss in the Wall, which to some informants suggests an image of the human mind trapped inside the skull, and which has been reported from Mobile, Alabama to Jacksonville, Florida, and on up the Atlantic coast for a few states more. Raw-headed, bloody bones would not remind you right away of the greasy man of Corpus Christi, Brownsville, and Porta Isabella, all Texas. In these places, however, greasy man is also known as string fellow or the string fellow. It's been conjectured that the latter name may come from the jerky, puppet-like walk attributed to the phenomenon. In New Orleans, of course, where every superstition flourishes, most of these names may be found, plus, as might be expected, the zombie, zumbi, jumbi, duppy group of names, see lime killer, with the important difference that no paper man, etc., has ever been alleged held to service or labor. In other words, zombie may have been at one time a slave, but paper man was not. Bagnell's notes. Bagnell had arranged for Vlad and Jack to stay at a college guest house where Bagnell himself had recently stayed while his house was being painted. In the drawer of a nightstand, Vlad found a sheaf of forgotten papers labeled duplicate of Dr. Bagnell's committee report. Vlad felt a twinge of scruple. Should he read it? But what has been duplicated can hardly be personal, so. Mr. Ernest Anderson is a trapper in a nearby state. He and his family moved into a structure known as the Old Lindsay Mill. The exterior is brick, but the inside is built of more eclectic materials. The main mill building has been closed for years, and the family lives in part of it. From the start of their residence there, it seems there were odd noises and odd smells, and one of the children claimed to have seen something. Mr. Anderson, being a trapper, set a number of traps. On the night of the given date, a loud noise was heard from the second floor, described as the rattling and thrashing of a creature caught in a trap. Mr. Anderson and other male relatives left the living quarters to rush upstairs, but then they heard loud screams and ran back to the living quarters because one of the children was having some sort of fit. Here Vlad's blood ran cold as he continued reading. Mr. Anderson drove the child to the West County Medical Center and it wasn't until much later that he was able to check the upstairs trap. It had been sprung, and inside the trap was a badly crushed, but easily identifiable human foot that seemed to be in a mummified condition. There was no sign of blood, and there was an immensely strong and fetid odor. I asked Mr. Anderson if the force of the trap being sprung could have severed the foot from the ankle. He answered, and remember that he has long been a trapper, he said that the foot had been gnawed off. Attached to the pages was an envelope, and inside the envelope was a horrible close-up photograph of the foot. Vlad let the pages flutter away. He tried to swallow, but found that he could not. After a while, he got up and went for a glass of water. "You all right, Vlad?" asked Jack from the adjoining room. "No, I am not." "Want to tell me about it?" "No, I don't." Vlad gave him the papers. Jack read them and looked up with an expression part puzzled, part unhappy. Vlad handed him the envelope. Jack looked at the photograph, then looked at Vlad with horrified eyes. "Jesus," he said. Vlad said, "What the hell? Is this a loop? Am I a prisoner in a Mobius strip, or is it all a bad dream?" Jack Stewart said, "No, it's not a bad dream. I'm sorry, I wish it were. I still don't know what it means, but it's not what we thought it meant, what we were told it meant. We're in another country from now on, a country with strange inhabitants and unknown boundaries." Bagnell's quest. Bagnell was walking on his way to see Larrabee again, who first developed the notion of the phenomenon of the one-legged man in the blue baseball cap. Bagnell did not know, but he knew the phenomenon well enough. "You never saw such a person in your life," the story went, "and the first day you see him, you see two more. Not merely two, mind you, but two more." Walking past the row of old stores which had, almost too late, been saved from destruction by a committee of concerned citizens, concerned and prosperous, called Rowan Row, simply because it was on Rowan Street. Walking along on the other side of the street, Bagnell looked up. He looked up with a jerk of his head. He had not intended to stop, for he had walked slowly past the old buildings earlier, had looked in the shop windows, seen nothing he wanted to examine closely. He looked up now with a jerk of his head. Had he seen, could he have seen a sign reading "Paper Man"? He had not. Not quite. The shop buildings were all of brick and one story high, and dated from the 1830s. Some attempt had been made to preserve or restore the period flavor. Where the tobacco store had been was a tobacco store now, and outside it was a wooden Indian. Apothecaries had a row of very attractive apothecaries jars on display, plus antique equipment in a glass case, and as for the rest, offered exactly what was sold in any other drugstore. "Pastime Paper Antiques," the sign read, which Bagnell had seen out of the corner of his ever-ready-to-deceive-you eyes. It had not caught his attention at first because it was actually above eye level on its own side of the street. He stared a moment. He crossed the street. In the window were such things as well-weathered marriage documents, illuminated in color in the Pennsylvania Dutch fracture style, with flowering trees never seen even in botanical gardens, on the boughs of which were distel finks, birds unknown to ornithology. There were a pair of U.S. Navy certificates identifying Chauncey Casey as caulker and Clarence Casey as sailmaker, dated in the 1890s. There were a few posters in extravagant tints and a small sedate notice, more inside. Bagnell noticed a selection of lacy valentines. Bagnell noticed the paper man in the very front part of the window. An old-fashioned bell bobbed and dipped and rang as Bagnell swung the door widely open. An informally, neatly dressed gentleman, in perhaps his early 40s, appeared from behind an oriental screen. "If there were a time travel machine," the man said, quizzing his eyebrows, "I'd go back and murder whoever it was who cut something out of this copy of Godey's Lady's Book, October 1842. Just imagine, does this interest you? Yours for a dollar." He thrust it forward, but Bagnell did not thrust a dollar at him. "I'd like to see one of the daguerreotypes in the window," Bagnell said. He realized that he was speaking very fast. He realized that he was breathing very fast. "The second one from the right." "Certainly. Please help yourself." The man gestured to two bowls on a little table and went forward to the window. With great control, Bagnell did not go with him, did not even turn to watch him. He examined the bowls. One contained small candies. The other was full of business cards reading, "Pastime Paper Antiques, number 7, Rowan Row. Mr. Sidney, proprietor." Mr. Sidney, proprietor, returned. He held in his hand what looked like a tiny book and handed it to Bagnell, who at once unclasped the tiny hook and reopened it. It was the right one. It was the likeness of a young man in uniform, in no way remarkable. One might see him or his mates today drinking canned beer and watching television anywhere in town, anywhere in the United States. "That is real leather and real brass, the casing, I mean, hardly to be found anymore anywhere, and the same goes for the satin facing the picture." Bagnell asked the price, and Mr. Sidney slipped behind the screen and returned with a loose-leaf notebook, which he now consulted. "Ah, yes, the collection of 6 daguerreotypes. I must tell you that they are actually ambrotypes, a slightly later process. But I follow your own usage, which is my own as well. The collection of 6 daguerreotypes are for sale at $1,000, plus, alas, state sales tax of 3.7%. Sell only the single one? Oh, I am afraid not. They are, after all, a collection, and I couldn't sell just one. Not for less than $200, that is. And no, we don't take credit cards or out-of-state checks. Sorry, these are, after all, collector's items and a very good investment." He proceeded to tell Bagnell about one such which had appreciated even as it sat in the window, adding, "Well, if these are still here when the weather gets hotter, of course, I will bring them inside because I am afraid of them fading." Curator Luke Larrabee gave a grunt of surprise at seeing Bagnell again so soon, but he was not uncivil and listened to him without interruption. He said,
"Calm down. We're not used to excitement here. In fact, haven't had any since the Yankee army passed through town. Thank the Lord they didn't stop to burn it." "Excitement, yes. I don't feel I can discount the possibility that you are still in a state of excitement. Even shock. It is a shocking sight. That photograph of mine and those things I showed you. So, oh, of course, I'll go stroll by and take a look at the one you say is in where? Rowan Row? Oh," he looked at the card Bagnell gave him. "It would be one of the most remarkable coincidences if actually they were, oh, Mr. Sidney, yes, know him, done business with him, business, you get the point? Sidney is not running a junkyard, now settle down, Rome wasn't built in a day, quit that fidgeting." Bagnell extended his stay at the motel, drove slowly back to the old Carolina Coast Museum, went up the blue slate steps, scooped and hollowed by the passing feet of a century. Larrabee was there and beckoned him in from inside his private office. "All right, saw it." "What? Of course it's the same face. Outrageous coincidence against all known laws of probability. However, we must have a copy of Sidney's Ambrose and work from there. No other choice. And it's up to you to get him to let you make that copy. They're not photographic negatives. You know that, of course. We'll have to photograph it and produce our own negative. Enlarge it. Well, enlarge them both. Go over them with magnifying lenses and fine-tooth comb. Have you got $200 cash on you, by the way? Ha, thought not." Bagnell found himself breathing rapidly again. "Look here, Luke." A silvery, tufted eyebrow shot up, but Larrabee listened. "This is absolutely the first time it's been even possible to think of its being even possible to provide any element of prehistory of a paper man, and you can't let it go by and risk losing it forever." Larrabee, still calm in his naturally cool, old-fashioned office, with sepia-tinted, framed photographs of his predecessors on its walls, Larrabee, still calm, said it was Bagnell's fault for showing enthusiasm. "However, I understand your emotion. Still, why he wants $200, $200 for a daguerreotype of a nobody, for that price, you ought to get one of Lola Montez naked, and I have not got that $200 in my budget." Bagnell gnawed his neat mustache. "Well, how much have you got that you can spend to borrow the picture? Just borrow it and have it copied. I mean, you absorb the copying costs, and I'm sure I can manage a pro rata share of it. How much?" The old curator sighed and canted his head and looked at his wall calendar. "Oh, $50? Tops." Mr. Sidney was cautious. Mr. Sidney smelled something. Bagnell offered to have it cleaned for him. "No charge." "Cleaned? It's as clean as a whistle. Look at it. Beautiful condition. What?"
"Okay, I'll come clean with you."
"Now we're talking."
The Carolina Coast Museum.
Oh, Lord, they don't have a button. Nothing doing. Oh, well, what's your offer?"
"An offer of $50 just to..." Mr. Sidney's shock was not assumed.
$50? No, no, out of the...
"Just to borrow it for 1 week for purposes of comparison with another picture." This was unexpected. Mr. Sidney seemed genuinely uncertain.
And what do I do if someone comes in off the row and asks, where's that old snapshot of the boy in uniform used to be in between baby Phoebe and Grandpa Jukes?
You say it's being cleaned. Would you like to put down a deposit? It will be cleaned for you, free.
It was immediately clear that Mr. Sidney liked this image. He nodded, his mouth worked, evidently silently repeating the words.
You have a suggestion there. Not bad. Very well. I feel able to do it for you and the museum, but for $75, impossible for less. Risk factor.
Slowly, Bagnell emptied his pockets. There was the fairly crisp $50 bill, and also there was a limp $20 bill and two dim ones and 50 cents.
His sigh was quite immediate. So was Mr. Sidney's reaction.
Oh, very well. The firm will settle for $70 and will cover state tax. The firm is not hard-hearted. Keep the $250 for lunch. The museum will probably offer you possum a la taxidermy.
Oh, and I shall require you to show some ID and to sign a little piece of paper.
And then shall I gift wrap it for you?
No, but remember now, not more than 1 week.
Company in the parlor, Curator Larrabee said briskly.
Bagnell blinked. An odd phrase to come from a self-admitted church member.
Company, in the small lecture room, doors locked, consisted of Hughes of the Southeastern Interstate Criminology Institute, commonly called the Crim Lab, and Dr. Preston Budworth of every hospital in town.
My colleagues insist that the best specialty is dermatology. They say the patients never die and they never get cured. They just keep coming back. And I say, true, but plastic surgeons make more. Oh boy, yes. Of course, we work hard for it. Oh, it's hell on the feet.
He said no more for the moment, the lights having then been turned off. Then he said, Jesus Christ. The slide of the paper man's head having briefly flashed on the screen.
Of course, I've seen worse, said Dr. Budworth.
Oh, lots worse, but seen nothing the same. What in salvation is it?
The copy of the ambrotype next appeared. Soldier boy, hey?
It remained a while, then the severed head with its cold, sly sneer came back to grimace at them.
Dr. Budworth cleared his throat and said, looks as though he'd been shot dead at Gettysburg and had his picture taken at Appomattox.
In a voice slow and heavy, Larrabee said,
perhaps you're right.
There was a silence, then broken by Hughes asking,
is this your question, curator? Are these two pictures of the same man? Is that it?
Larrabee said yes, that was it. Was asked to show both slides side by side. Did so. Hughes then said he thought they might well be.
For instance, that drooping.
Oh, excuse me, Dr. Budworth. But Budworth told him to go on.
That drooping eyelid. And then you observed the crease in the earlobe. Can you see that really very slight scar on the cheekbone on the opposite side from the drooping eyelid? And of course, in the, I assume, post-mortem photo, some of the teeth are exposed, and you see that the left canine is crooked and protrudes. Of course, in the one in uniform, he has his mouth closed, but there is still a slight protrusion just over where that canine would be.
Now, these are technical observations, though not very technical. And of course, my simple guess would have been anyway that it is the same person, some years apart,
though I wouldn't offhand guess how many. Not more than 10, I'd say. Maybe even 5, or a bit less, since war being war, you know. The post-mortem photo, a perfectly correct description certainly, had been cropped in the copying process, and it was not evident that the head was separate from the torso. If Hughes suspected anything, Hughes was not saying. To Bagnell, trying to put aside what he knew, merely the difference in the photographic techniques, more than a century apart, was obvious. Preston Budworth's comments were more technical, but he came to the same conclusion.
Of course, I would want to make measurements and enlarge the pictures even more on as close to even scale as possible before I'd sign my name to anything. Not that I'm going to anyway. Historical detective work is lots of fun, of course, and nobody waiting to sue you for malpractice. Well, I wouldn't want to ask where you got that ghouly-looking one from. Promptly, Hughes said,
I would. I will. Where? But they did not tell him. Not yet.
Military historians identified uniform coat and badges as those of the 23rd Patriot Rifles. Phone calls in all directions finally produced Charles O'Neill Sturtevant, Colonel, USA retired, who had an enormous collection of Civil War photographs, and,
mind you, young man, it's a loan. Your balls are in bond for it.
Yes, Colonel, of course, anytime you like, sir, babbled Bagnell, scarcely knowing what he was saying. On that red-letter day, against what awesome odds, Ed Bagnell found what he was hoping for, printed off a cracked, wet plate, though only slightly cracked, the likeness of three young men, frozen stolid, hands on knees, and on the back, the signatures, two florid and scrawly, one awkward and cramped, Corporal W. M. Ewing, Private Elwin Michaels, Private Ephraim McElwit. Now, for the first time, there was a name. The 23rd Patriot Rifles had been enlisted in Gainsborough, as far to the south as it was perhaps possible for a northern town to be. And there Bagnell went, as fast as was consistent with speed laws, and energy consistent with small packets of crackers and cheese sold in gas stations. In the Gainsborough phone book, he pushed a restless finger down the columns in search of people named McElwit. He found not one. That is, the current one contained not one, at the public library in the reference room.
Out-of-date telephone directories? No, we don't keep them.
Oh, sinking voice, sinking feeling.
But I'll tell you who does. Mr. Roadheaver does. I'll write down the address for you.
Homer would have felt at home in the old room where Mr. Roadheaver worked. Bagnell felt that if he had wanted the directory for Fusby LaMud, 1901, it would have been there. Mr. Roadheaver perhaps collected them, perhaps compiled mailing lists, or traced missing heirs. Bagnell didn't care. Mr. Roadheaver was getting on in years, and he listened patiently. Then he asked,
what's it worth to you?
Worth?
Is it worth $5?
Mr. Roadheaver began to pull down old phone books and pile them on his dusty desk, beckoned Bagnell to come look, waited while he did, ceasing 3 years before
but as far back from then, farther back than Bagnell cared to go, a Mrs. Lambert McElwit had lived at 269 Longfellow Avenue. Bagnell copied the address, handed the man a crumpled $5 bill.
"Well, there's lunch," said Mr. Roadheaver.
Did she still live there? Had she died 3 years ago? Had she just given up her phone, there being too few left alive to call her? Or perhaps there had been some difficulty about a bill, and she had let her listing lapse, and had a phone installed in the name of a neighbor, friend, or, well, probably not. But, hurt to try? Maybe find a lead. Leads had been found, one after another. 269 was in rather better shape than the other houses, which had all once been neat and bright long ago. And Mrs. McElwit lived in a little room on the top floor, whither he was directed by a series of ageless women in cotton house dresses, of whom each seemed to have three children and one in utero. But Mrs. McElwit was not ageless. Mrs. McElwit was very aged indeed, and her skin hung in heavy flaps. Did she know of an Ephraim McElwit who had served in the Civil War? A silence. The room smelled, rather, but of nothing worse than old people's flesh and of cabbage. And perhaps it was only the neighbor's cabbage. The room contained what was left of her life as it had drawn in upon itself, decade after decade. There was hardly room enough to move, although no doubt the woman who lived there had moved enough. She sat in her chair, and she did not move now, and she stared at nothing which other people could see. Silence. Then, "He disappeared," she said at last. "Lambert's, my husband's, aunt's, used to speak of him. He was the black sheep of the family. He went away and he never came back. Yes, he disappeared." Bagnell had brought another picture along of another group of soldiers as a sort of control, and now he put both in her hands. "Might you recognize a family resemblance?" She pushed one away after a glance, but the other one she looked at long and long.
"A family resemblance? Yes, the one at the end. On the right, he has Lambert's look. Yes, he has Lambert's look."
And very silently, her slow tears rained along the ruined landscape of her face. A family resemblance. Is not Ephraim a beloved child? And what had he come to? A thing in three boxes, shriveled, withered, broken, and foul. But now at last, thank God, forever dead. Bagnell to Larrabee. Where was Ephraim McElwit? That is, where was the paper man found? Come clean.
Basement storeroom in an old private girls' school in Gainsborough. A couple years ago, Musty was picking up a little extra money there as a weekend relief watchman, said Larrabee.
Thither went Dr. Claire Zimmerman at Bagnell's request to interview the headmistress, Mrs. Sidwell.
"Yes, this is one of the oldest houses in town. It is well preserved and consequently required no major restorations. It has made an excellent private school building."
Mrs. Sidwell stopped and thought.
"Do I recall anything odd happening a couple of years ago? Well, there was a, I suppose the word I have to use is prank. It's difficult to say when a prank gets out of hand and becomes something more. Dr. Rose Bennett asked me into her advanced English class during a morning break. She said there was something on the blackboard she didn't like. Of course, I expected what we used to call a naughty word. Are there any more naughty words? I haven't quite grown used to hearing sweet girls talking like sailors. Well, no, it wasn't a naughty word. The words nothing but death were written on the blackboard, and the writing was odd, somehow wrong. The next day, the same words were written on a blackboard in room A6, and the following morning, there it was again. Security and maintenance promised to keep a close watch on room A6, and the next day, the words nothing but death appeared in room C12. When that happened, everybody began to get nervous. Well, we photographed the words, sponged all the blackboards, and read the riot act to security and maintenance, but still it appeared. Of course you'd like to see it. Mrs. Sidwell rummaged in a drawer and handed an enlarged photograph to Claire, who studied it intently. Then Rose Bennett remembered that those were Jane Austen's dying words, but the handwriting bore no resemblance to samples of Jane Austen's, and we weren't even teaching Jane Austen that year, so our school was being haunted by a specter with a good knowledge of early 19th century English literature. But who? Judging from the cramped and wavering writing, it must have been somebody very sick or very tired, said Claire. Oh, my, I don't like the sound of that. Though you're probably right, I must say, the whole thing gave me the creeps. Do you think somebody very old wrote it? The writing looks so weak and old-fashioned. But why would an old person come creeping in like that? I asked Rose Bennett what the class had been discussing the day before the words appeared. She remembered that she had asked them, if you could be granted only one wish, what would you wish for? The next morning, the words began to appear, nothing but death. Then just as suddenly, it stopped. Claire examined the photograph closely. What's that down at the bottom of the blackboard? It looks like the letters E.M. in the same writing. Oh, yes, sometimes that appeared too. But nobody here knew what it meant, said Mrs. Sidwell. And then the bell rang, and she had to go. Vlad Smith and Jack Stewart were bedded down in an old-fashioned tourist guest house for the night. It was owned by Mrs. Warrington, who looked like a gentlewoman in reduced circumstances. A bottle and glasses stood on the table next to a small pile of rather unprofessional-looking printed matter. Jack tugged a comb through his tangled molasses curls and picked one up. Nice old guy who gave us these, he said. Mr. Pabrocky. All these years, he's been sending you these things, and then all of a sudden you turn up on his doorstep. The News Bulletin of the Atlantic Folklore. Two words and no hyphen. Very dubious usage. Club, he read. Volume 15, number 11, to be precise. Who's boss in your wall? Cute, hey? There is a story told particularly in the southeastern and south central states of a spook or specter or bogle or haunt who
inhabits houses, inhabitants' houses, and other older, usually, buildings. He is musty and gaunt, and lives in the walls and floors and empty rooms, and is seldom seen. The description is that he is skeletal, but unlike other such myths, he is depicted as wearing old clothes and is afraid of cats and fires, perhaps because he is all dried up. It is quite a task to look this subject up in indexes and bibliographies, for one thing, because it has so many names, and for another, so little seems to have been published. So we urge our members to make inquiries wherever they happen to be. Perhaps our little amateur news bulletin may provide some information which the learned quarterlies have not. This folk tale figure is called Paper Man because he lives behind the wallpaper, which used to be on every wall, but now no longer, owing to the high cost and labor, and also, we assume, because of a prejudice that bugs breed there. This creature issues a noise which is variously described as clicking or clattering or even rustling, hence the various names of rustler or clicker, as well as the boss in the wall. Another name is house devil, and Mary May Subchak reports she has heard it referred to as the devil in the wall. Stewart next applied his lips to a glass, then said, "Well, I would give this a B-. You, Dr. Smith? Trouble with amateurs, they are always reinventing the wheel." "More on Paper Man names," continued Jack Red. "We find that the so-called Minorcan, descended people of St. Augustine, Florida, employ the name or term Clicky Dicky. Alas, for our hopes that we might find some such Spanish survival variants. Crossing the peninsula to Pensacola, we note that Clicky Dicky has become Tricky Dicky, a term extending as far south on that coast as Tampa. We were unable to find this legend at all in St. Petersburg, Florida, an absence tentatively attributed to the northern origin of so many people in the winter capital. Mr. Pabrocki has suggested, with the well-known twinkle in his eye, that it is remarkable nonetheless that neither Clicker nor Clicky Dicky is to be found where there are so many senior citizens, of whom he is one, considering how many of them have the medically well-known condition, a clicking kneecap. Humor apart, this does raise the question if the clicking attributed to the specter comes from the sound of teeth, as had generally been believed, or to some other source. Jack put the news bulletin down. Vlad sighed wearily. "Is there any more brandy in the bottle?" There was no more brandy in the bottle. They argued back and forth about opening another bottle. Each took both sides. Then they opened another bottle. "Should we read more mind-improving books now?" asked Jack. Vlad said he'd rather write a mind-improving book called The Myth of the Paper Man, Examined and Refuted. Even that title shows how far I've come in my thinking, A month ago, I'd no more have needed to refute it than I would have refuted Dracula or Frankenstein. Household words. Everybody knows about them, but nobody believes in them or cowers in fear of them. Jack slipped a cassette of Buxta Hude's Nisa Brevis into his little old cassette player. His movements made goofy shadows on the wall. "That nice?" he asked.
"More than nice. It's ravishing," said Vlad sleepily. "When it's over, play it again, Sam."
Perhaps Sam had played it again, but now it was not playing. A shadow was playing on the floor, which Goofy would not describe. It looked like the shadow of an enormous four-legged spider gliding upside down across the floor. Whatever it was looked horrible. Dear God, would he forever be seeing horrid and impossible things? Jack was sitting up in his bed, with his face gone ghastly. Then he leaped out of his bed and out of their room and went roaring and running down the hallway.
"Where did it go? Did you see it, Vlad? It ran along the ceiling."
Jack dragged a table and chair into the hallway and started to climb on it. Mrs. Warrington appeared with her hair in a gray-streaked braid and a man's bathrobe over her nightgown. She stretched out her hands and called,
"Mr. Stewart, you must stop this now."
"Ms. Warrington, where did it go? Where did it come from? What lives in this hallway?"
Many expressions passed rapidly over her worn face, but now they settled into one expression. A gentlewoman in reduced circumstances.
"Mr. Stewart,"
she said in a quick but firm and level voice,
"I am very sorry that you had a bad dream, but I will not be shouted at in my own house, and I refuse to hold a conversation with a strange man in his underwear. Please take the table and chair back, sir."
"No, I won't, Ms. Warrington, not yet. Please excuse me, ma'am," said Jack as he climbed onto the table and chair and began to examine the imperfect surface of the ceiling. Mrs. Warrington was actually wringing her hands.
"What is he doing? Can't you make him stop, Professor Smith? You have terrified me with those awful yells, and now this. What is it?"
Jack said in doleful tones, "It didn't rattle or click, but I know what it is, ma'am, and I reckon you know too." The woman's face seemed to collapse in upon itself, and she tottered and leaned against the wall for just a moment, then sprang away as though it were red hot. Her voice was now trembling but fierce.
"This guest house is all I have to live on. I don't know who you are, but I want you to get out right now. I don't want your money. Please go."
They went as soon as they could dress and pack. Without discussion, they left money on the table. When they got into the car and drove in silence with Vlad behind the wheel. Then they got into the car and drove in silence with Vlad behind the wheel. His sallow face was weary, and his blue-gray eyes were troubled and gray.
"What did you see?"
Vlad finally asked.
"I woke up and saw this thing scuttling across the ceiling. Something like a man, but horribly bony and filthy, and utterly nasty in some way I can't describe. You?"
"I just saw the shadow," said Vlad. "I never heard of one on the ceiling."
It was clinging by its long nails to the tiny gaps in the plaster, and the flaps of torn clothing swayed And that vile body swayed too. I don't know where it came from or where it went to. There's no window or hatchway, only a little ventilation slit that maybe a rat could get through, but not a man. Eventually, they stopped at the brightest and newest motel they could find, with walls too thin for even a roach to hide. Mr. Pabrocki's news bulletin led Vlad and Jack to a privately endowed art museum. They were repeating a list of names to the museum lady, and the list had begun to seem very tiresome and, indeed, loathsome. "Or the boss in the wall?" Vlad finished the list, and a look of great surprise came over her face. She said, "Of course, Hobson's ghost. You know that all institutions have their skeletons in the closet. That one is ours. Long ago, we bought what is known as a primitive portrait, meaning it was painted by a self-taught, itinerant artist. It showed a woman sitting in a room. Evidently, something was painted into the picture, which wasn't apparent. Something was painted over, and then the overpaint sloughed off. It rose to the surface like a ghost, and it was ghost-like and quite famous for a while. But finally, we had to take the picture off exhibition because parents complained that it scared their children, and it probably scared them. On the old acquisition slip is written Hobson. We aren't sure if that's the subject or the artist, and faintly penciled in is Boss in the Wall, whatever that means. Would you like to see it?" Primitive it certainly was. A late middle-aged woman sat stiffly in a chair in an old-fashioned room. Her skirt was long and black, her shawl was white, and her face was stiff. Above her was something gray and ghastly that seemed to ooze from a panel in the wall. It looked like the bleached carapace of a long-dead spider, with bared teeth and skeletal hands, with clawing nails. Its expression was both fearful and malignant. Hobson's ghost.
Oh God, yes, said Vlad in a sick, weak voice. That's it. A boss in the wall. Do you know any more about it?
Well, there is an old story about a Henry and Hannah Hobson, who were settlers over in Blainesville. He was a widower, she a widow. He wanted to move west to live with his children. She wanted to move east to live with her children. Folks didn't divorce or separate in those days, so they quarreled day and night. Then either he got sick and she let him die without calling a doctor, or she slowly poisoned his food. Anyway, his last words were that he'd never leave the house alive, and neither would she. And after he died, she never did leave. She packed more than once, but never left. Then old Hobson began to haunt her. One time or another, that wretched woman lived in every room of the house. No use. He'd find her. So in the end, she hanged herself. There's even an old song about it. The museum lady began to sing in a wavering voice.
How the night winds howl, for death seems near to me. Beware, Mr. Hobson, do not drink that tea. I fear my time is fleeting, and death comes in a rush. Beware, Mr. Hobson, do not sup that mush. I fear my bad wife, Hannah, and I fear my time has come. Beware, Mr. Hobson, do not drink that rum. So stand back, good Christian people, and do not heed her calls, for to haunt my bad wife Hannah, I slink slowly through the walls.
Now Vlad and Jack were talking to Henry Wabershaw.
I'm named for my grandfather's old Russian friend, Vladimir.
I'm named for my grandfather's old Russian friend, Vladimir. For Smithville is full of Edgars, but how many Vlad Smiths are there? Said Vlad. If inside of Wabershaw's great fat man's body there was a thin man screaming to get out, the screaming was inaudible to either Vlad or Jack.
You fellows from the committee?
Asked Wabershaw in a small voice almost stifled by his immense flesh.
The committee? Asked Vlad. That makes as much sense as Larrabee's got one.
Perhaps Wabershaw understood the nuances of the remark, and perhaps he did not. What he said was,
So you know about Larrabee, hmm?
He nodded the small face set inside the very large one and gave them an odd look. After a moment, he sighed and said,
I'm sorry I can't ask you boys to have a bite to eat, but there's not a bite in the house.
He gazed at them as if he had given a sign and were waiting for a countersign. Vlad and Jack had been warned that the way to Wabershaw's heart and head was through his stomach, for he was surely eating himself to death, so they were prepared. Stuart now said,
As to that, Mr. Wabershaw, as we hadn't yet had our dinner, we took the liberty of bringing you a little something along and wondered if you'd have some with us.
He lifted the large paper sacks onto the table.
Why, fried chicken. I always say that fried chicken is the friend of man. And how I love potato salad. Three kinds of bread, real butter, French mustard. And look at these tempting cold cups. Oh, I am very fond of raspberry soda. And what might be in this other bag? Chinese food. Is there anything nicer than Chinese food?
Then he peeped into a cardboard box and exclaimed with almost erotic glee,
What a lovely cake!
Pieces of fried chicken were already on the way to his turtle-like mouth when he paused and said,
You boys aren't from the committee. Catch any of them giving anything. They just take. Bagnell, Calloway, Zimmerman, Elbaum, Branch, and the rest of that bunch. They want it all for themselves.
Branch, cried Vlad.
By and by, the galloping consumption of food slowed down to a mere nibbling. Wabershaw surveyed the wreckage on the table with elephantine calm and said,
Happiest day of my life.
Which day was that? Asked Vlad.
When I first realized that the boss in the wall was real. Why? Because on that day I knew for sure that I was not going crazy.
I can appreciate that,
said Vlad with heartfelt sincerity.
When you've been hearing things you can't see and seeing things you can't believe, why, a fear builds up inside you and your life sort of slumps sideways into a different universe. I tried staying away from home, sleeping in the office and sleeping in hotels. I tried getting drunk and staying drunk, and I lost my good job as state historian. I was hospitalized twice for nervous breakdowns, and in the hospital I began to put on flesh. Then, one day I realized I was not crazy, so I came home, and I found a man with trained ferrets, and we sent those ferrets into the walls. Then we heard a terrible thrashing sound in the storeroom, and by the time we got there, it was dead. But it had bit some of the ferrets to pieces. The man was pretty mad and made me pay plenty for the loss of his critters. But I rejoiced, for just the sight and smell of that house devil proved I wasn't crazy. I burned it in the fireplace, for it was very dry, and now I keep openings in the walls for my cats, who can get to any part of this house, and who serve to give warning if needed. You can feel safe here, professors. This house has been purged. This house is pure.
Vlad recalled Papa John's words to Uncle Mose, "Get you a cat." Then Wabershaw placed his vasty paw over Vlad's very ordinary hand in a reassuring way that persuaded Vlad that once upon a time, before he became an eccentric though harmless monster, Henry Wabershaw must have been a very nice fellow. He said, "So now I stay home, for I no longer fear for my sanity, and I don't drink anymore. I just eat." Vlad said,
"You have come face to face with the same thing which persuaded us that this myth is no myth. Namely, we have also seen the creatures. Now the question is, how did they come to exist? For if we know what started them, maybe we'll know how to stop them."
Wabershaw shifted his great weight in his reinforced chair, reached in a drawer and handed Vlad a manila envelope. "Seen anything like this?" he asked as Vlad removed a sheaf of papers labeled "First Draft of the Interim Committee Report." Vlad made a sound of surprise, for the papers were in the same format as those Bagnell had left behind in the nightstand of the Sumner College guest house. He began to read. "They are commonly known as rattlers or rustlers, but in places as far apart as San Francisco and St. Louis, the favorite term is clickers. In certain border states, the obscure hyet is found, which may be related to raw-headed, bloody bones. In Biloxi, the favored terms are boss devil or devil in the wall. Dr. Alan Lee Murrow, the great southern folklorist, says this may be an extension of the zombie legends, or that the zombie may have its origins here. Dr. Robert Albright notes the Yazoo Delta fable that hyets died of yellow fever or plague and eat human flesh. Hamling Calloway, M.D., raises the question of whether there might be an unidentified retrovirus or microorganism somehow associated with the Great Plague, perhaps as a fellow traveler, which might in some way cause the phenomena that lie at the bottom of these tales. Something which resembles life, some unrecognized viral wasting syndrome or plague which causes pseudo-life. And if so, is this plague still active now?" Brad let the papers drop on the still-littered table, sighed and rubbed his eyes.
"What do you think?" he asked Wabershaw.
"Professors, as near as I am confident, there is a disease never diagnosed which simulates death, and which then simulates life, and which still, from time to time, simulates it now, from the time when their normal body processes sink below a certain point. Those old paper men are neither alive as we know it, nor dead as we know it. They lie motionless behind countless walls, not crumbling to dust, until something disturbs them, and then they go clicking and clattering and rustling and rattling until their clock runs down again. Then they go back inside the walls until something winds them up again. I have often wondered how many of those poor old derelicts we see nodding and mumbling in doorways of old buildings
are in fact suffering from paper man's disease. They wrap themselves in rags and newspapers to stay warm and crawl into a niche in some wall. They keep themselves alive with an occasional rat, for rats are known to run along walls, and they sink into a hibernating sleep, a hibernating state, until something wakes them, then they attack. I knew all this before those fancy committee fellows did. I tried to tell them, but they wouldn't listen. They knew better. Well, hell with them. Young Professor Stewart, there's a gallon of sweet milk in the icebox. If you'd be so kind to bring it out. Five, the committee. Gertrude, Mrs. Harry Brown, Roberts, had finally, after years of trying everything in the pharmacopoeia, found something which would put her to sleep and keep her to sleep 10 minutes after she had taken it, an interval long enough to read her nightly number of lines from the Bible and to say her prayers. She now left the Catholics and Episcopalians for last as she drifted into slumber. Her toothless mouth would open in her bony face and she would begin to snore. This, as it usually woke him up, was her old husband's signal that he was once again a free man for the night.
So, Gertrude Sayre,
he hissed at the unresponsive body on the far side of the bed.
Taking more than a thimbleful of brandy is wrong, is it? But doping your soul into subconsciousness with that chemical counterfeit of poppy and mandragore is all right, is it? Stuff, poppycock, but just like a Sayre.
Old Harry Roberts got out of bed. The night air being just a bit chill, he put on his second best frock coat, the one he saved for commencements and inaugurations, saving the very best one for board meetings, over his nightshirt, and shuffled along the street in his carpet slippers. There were no passers-by, and had there been, few would have given him a second glance, and had any done so, it would have been a glance of approval. New England still dearly cherished its eccentrics. Had any identified him as one? H. Brown Roberts was soon at a certain side door to the General Museum of the Province of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, of which he was still librarian emeritus and a member of the Budget Committee. He let himself in with his keys. A moment later, he was once again deep into the immense annals of the Underground Railroad, on which he had long planned a series of books, and thus he stayed. From time to frequent time, he muttered to himself about the Fugitive Slave Act and the Free Soil Whigs, and his great-grandmother Brown and his great-grandfather Roberts, both of whom were conductors on the Underground Railroad. When glancing up, he observed one of the passengers.
"Oh, my poor fellow," HBR exclaimed, rising to his feet. "Are you one of the stowaways aboard the cotton boat from Charleston? Never do fear. We shall see you safe to Canada. But perhaps you are hungry. Did they give you some hot victuals in the kitchen?" "What? Not? Well, just you come with me."
The hallway seemed a trifle strange to him as he padded along it, followed by the silent figure. Presently they entered another room, which he did not precisely recognize as either a part of the old Roberts or of the old Brown house, although, to be sure, some of the furnishings. It was not the kitchen, whatever it was, although,
there is the porcelain ginger jar which merchant Hukwa of the Hong gave to Reuben Roberts. I believe that in this cabinet one should find... Drat, it is locked. Pshaw, have you perchance with you? No, I suppose not. A lever with a thin end to it.
The dark and silent stowaway produced an enormous screwdriver and had the cabinet opened in a second. Inside, however, was no bread, no cold meat or mutton soup, no hasty pudding. What there was in it were two bottles of brandy. Seizing first one, then the other, the liberated three-fifths of a person smote the bottom of each bottle a great blow with the flat of his great hand, neatly popped each cork, and handed one bottle to Dr. H. Brown Roberts.
An excellent stratagem.
Yes, yes. No glasses, I suppose, in the cotton fields, away.
He raised his bottle and sniffed.
An excellent fundador.
Ha hum. Here is to your good health, my man, and my brother, and to your prosperity in Nova Scotia.
Aha.
The dark stranger was an excellent guest, that is, he neither interrupted nor made any comment himself. When his voice was heard for the first time, it was deep and rough.
I want that head.
Oh, you do, do you? Do you? If you expect to trade it to the Blue Noses for rum, let me tell you that a quarter quintal of codfish would be a likelier item.
Harry Roberts looked at his guest and had another tot from the brandy bottle, and why not? He was already saved, wasn't he? Yes, he was.
Well, it doesn't signify, and I see no reason why you shouldn't have it, for the acquisition was never authorized. Want that head? With taste and scent. No argument. Old Reuben Roberts brought one back from the Moluccas, packed in cloves once. Well, the cloves were from the Moluccas.
They were walking down the hall by now.
Here we are. I have a key to the door, but my key no longer fits this lock, for Selby Silas, wretched fellow, had the lock changed. Confound him, a Methodist.
A few wrenches with the huge screwdriver and another cabinet was open. A hideous odor filled the room. There was the head, and the supposed follower of the drinking gourd gave a grunt of recognition.
Don't touch it, my good fellow. They will scarcely let you on the cars if you reek of it, and certainly it would frighten the horses. Scrape it off the shelf into these plastic bags and tie a knot. Drop them into this one. Tie another knot and another. Ha, Selby Silas. His face will be a sight. Well, was it an authorized acquisition? No, it was not. You are going now? Avoid Boston. The cotton brokers are hand in glove with the... Well, I needn't tell you. Travel only at night. And take the back roads to Amherst. Rattle on the near windows of Moses Stewart, the house with the high stone fence.
The librarian Emeritus affixed a small piece of paper from the wastebasket, its back was unused, to the cabinet door with a very tiny piece of scotch tape, wrote April Fool on it, and decided to go home. Harry Roberts, who rumor had it owned half the mortgages in Newport, hid the bottle between great-grand-uncle Erastus Everett's second edition of Johnson's Lives of the Poets, where Gertrude eventually found it, as she eventually found everything. She never said a word, but decided it was time to bake fruit cake. The raisins were getting dry anyway, and with the windfall of the Spanish brandy, the cake should be just about ready to eat by Christmas. The mustee had not, as a matter of fact, planned on taking the horse cars or whatever remnants of the railroad which capital, management, labor, or government had left of the system. He made his way to a certain section of town, and there he walked slowly up and down the emptied streets, looking at license plates, furthest southern origin he could find was New York, so with a shrug and a rather rapid use of the useful screwdriver, he let himself into the small truck's cab, dropped his burden between his knees, and applied his lips to the brandy bottle. Then he simply settled into his seat and waited. After a while, someone else, humming a frolicsome air, also entered the truck cab, though from the other side, and catching sight of his passenger, attempted to tumble out backwards. A very long, very strong arm caught and drew him back in.
"We going south,"
said the musty.
"Yes, sir, Big Blood," the driver said. "We going south, no doubt about that."
Crossing into New York City in the gritty light of dawn, the driver realized that although his passenger was either dead or dead drunk, the truck was not his own. He therefore parked the vehicle in front of its owner's garage, gestured to the owner, and called,
"You got it."
Then he left the truck, turned a corner, and ran like hell. The owner did not put down his coffee. He languidly eyed the truck, languidly kicked a tire, locked the garage, and ambled off to breakfast. The truck was already under the scrutiny of the pioneer squad of a social group, called many amusing names by those who were not themselves members, though not as a rule in the presence of the social group, all of whom hailed from a lovely tropical hamlet near Ponce. The group members called themselves the Christian Heroes. They cared little that the religious practices of their native hamlet were not up to the highest standards of orthodoxy, and little cared their fathers and their mothers. The pioneer squad of the Heroes advanced, peered into the truck and its cab, reported that the truck itself was empty, but that the cab contained a comatose black man holding onto an empty bottle and a plastic bag. The Taino and Arawak presence in their native island had been absorbed too long ago for them to recognize the musty as half Indian. In fact, the slack of the bag was wound tightly around his hand. The Christian Heroes held a brief council, then deployed their forces.
"Andale, la bolsa,"
cried the smallest hero, as he was hoisted into the open cab window with a very sharp knife and very deftly cut the plastic and snatched the bag away. A jacket was tossed over the plastic bag. The heroes wandered away and eventually returned to their headquarters, a semi-occupied storeroom behind a small botanica, whose proprietor was an honorary hero. There the reeking bag or bags were opened. Alas, no grass. Some of the heroes uttered exclamations, not of enthusiasm. But the honorary member, with a look of the utmost gravity, had his own exclamation to utter as he knelt and crossed himself.
"Esta la cabeza de Santo Mumbo."
Something of Africa was, after all, recognized in the eclectic pantheon of the Christian Heroes. One by one, the others knelt down and followed his example. Sergeant Riley said,
"Be right. Here's another one from one of them Boyan Doubt houses on Corona Street. Telephone call says they worshiping the devil's head with dead chickens and all of that blasphemy stuff."
He gave his own head an angry shake, as though regretful that all of that blasphemy stuff had not constituted an indictable offense in New York State since 1797, People versus Jemima Wilkerson. "So, Lopez, Levine, and take the visiting Royal Canadian witches and tell them to muffle his horse's hooves. Whore, whore." Riley went back to his coffee.
Worshipping the devil's head?
Exclaimed Corporal Clan Renald.
Eh?
All the police repeated.
Eh?
In chorus and laughed heartily. All had been very interested that a corporal from the RCMP would be with them a little while as part of a crash course in urban crime. All had been disappointed that the corporal had not worn his scarlet Mountie coat, but his accent was meat for much merriment. Corporal Clan Renald of originally Trail BC, to whom urban crime had largely meant drunken pea soupers peeing in the streets and drunken Indians ineptly trying to take the tires off cars not theirs and mashing their fingers in the process, and drunken Manitoba French medis singing Voyager songs under the street lamps at 2 a.m. To Corporal Clan Renald, New York City urban crime was something else. But even so, worshipping the devil's head was something else yet. The benign Sunday schools of the United Church of Canada had not prepared him for metropolitan diabolism. The police car slowed down in that borough where Thomas Wolfe had long ago heard the peaceful sound of a million Jews turning the pages of the Sunday Times. Times had changed. Here we are, Corp. See, some kid. I guess he was laying chicky. He just run in to give the word. Then, and only then, as the car was parked in front of a smoke-streaked apartment building, whose doorless doorway was heaped with rubbish, did they briefly turn on the siren. Absolute shells, wreckages of other fires, or mere heaps of rubble. Cellars of demolished houses, houses which had been burned repeatedly long after any insurance could possibly have been issued. This is what they saw on Corona Street in that block. Visiting RCMP, Corporal Clan Renald hissed and pointed. Look, they're running out the back and getting away. Fine, we don't want them, said Lopez. The tombs is full enough as it is, Levine said. The three men got out of the car and gingerly entered the building. Stale reek of smoke still clung to it. Doorways gaped, now suddenly galvanized. Lopez and Levine loudly clumped their feet on the steps, called out, Police! A last clatter of their feet, then silence. On the second floor, an entire wall had been knocked out, and in the large room which had resulted, they found the evidence of the ceremony they had interrupted. On the walls were holy pictures of Mother Mary and the Caribbean Indian saint Maria Leonza riding nude upon her horse, all affixed with thumbtacks or scotch tape. On one wall hung a crucifix. In front of the crucifix was a table, and in front of the table lay three headless black chickens and three headless white chickens. Their heads were on the table. So was smoldering incense. So were piles of wilting fruit and flowers and little bowls piled with unknown substances. Also cigars and candles, red and yellow and blue and black. So was... Clan Renald pointed. My God, what is that? In the center of the table it sat. Its mouth was smeared with fresh blood, and it seemed to leer at them out of the side of its single open eye, slyly. Oh, that's horrible. What is it? Weren't you listening? That's the devil's head. It looks like it, too, said Levine. Gewalt. What did they do? Somebody rob a grave? Stay here, Royal, will ya? We gotta look around and radio the photographers. Be right back. Malcolm Clan Renald would easily have preferred to do other things than stay here, but he stayed as ordered, as he told himself he would have done in the frozen northern Yukon. It was then
under the unremitting gaze of the horrible head on the table, altar. He bethought himself of his own small personal camera and took it from his pocket and snapped a few photographs to show the folks in B.C. before Lopez and Levine returned, eventually followed by the official police photographers. What became of the head after its removal to the New York police lab, he never learned. For soon, the course in urban crime was completed, and Clan Renaud was back in Canada. There he developed the photographs himself, and there one of the folks in BC had connections with a sensationalist newspaper. The corporal was not an especially talented photographer, and most of the shots were ho-hum. But one single one was clear enough and ghastly enough to be picked up by a press syndicate. So for the first time in New York, in newspapers throughout North America, appeared the likeness of a paper man's head, though none of the caption writers called it by that name. Genevieve Silas, Selby's widowed sister-in-law and housekeeper, had made fish cakes and baked beans for breakfast again. Often had he told her that he detested them at all times, and especially for breakfast, uselessly. So he was not in the best mood when the phone rang. Silas here.
Yeah, well, this is Riordan here. What the hell have you been doing with the head I examined? What's it doing in New York?
It took a few seconds for Silas to isolate this Riordan from the vast number of tribesmen of that name.
Doing with it, my dear Dr. Riordan?
The object is in a locked cabinet, in a locked room, and has certainly not been in New York City. The dental surgeon's voice cut in on his polite protest.
Worshipping the devil's head, the papers say.
Well, they do sometimes turn up as cult objects, yes, but I never heard of one in New York. Riordan did not believe him, and Riordan did not believe that he had seen no such picture in the newspaper. Riordan said the New York City police had somehow had the teeth examined by someone who knew something, and this someone said that the teeth of this evidently ancient head had not only been recently drilled, but drilled by the new experimental Davenport drill. And you know how many of them there are? Damned few. If this gets traced to me, well, God won't help you. With these cryptic words, Edward L. Riordan salted the pile of unread newspapers on the reading, running down the hall and fumbling with the